that's where the curious cats can be persuaded, I think, like you say, to be, you know, it's not about you prompting hard enough. And prompting hard enough is the classic religious answer. You know, you're not holding it right. You're not,
exactly.
You know, you're not.
It doesn't work. Prompt harder.
Yeah, prompt harder. Yeah. The prompting will continue until morale improves, you know, so those kind of things. So, I mean, a friend of mine recently said, oh, we had this AI produced some code and then we spent 3 days debugging it. It's like, well, again, in terms of leverage, how long do you spend debugging these things, reviewing these things to the point where you just get too exhausted and you just think, I might as well just write it myself. It's not actually adding anything. It's distracting something.
Since the invention of the wheel, automation has both substituted and complemented labor. Machines replaced humans at some lower-paying jobs, but this was compensated by the creation of new, higher-paying jobs. In other words, tech workers. In recent years, there has been a desire from certain high-profile tech companies for an apolitical workplace. This in itself is a political act, an act designed to suppress the power of tech workers and reinforce the status quo. They know that politics is inextricable from tech, and now, so do you. Welcome to Politics.
Ray, we need to talk about programmers.
Programmers. Yeah. Programmers, the people who are actually doing the work.
Indeed.
Yeah, I think we spoke last time about the various communities. And yeah, I think the question is like, just recap those communities. First of all, there's like people who are writing this stuff and using this stuff. They fall into a lot of different camps. So there's people in the center who do the research, who write the core technology. So the people at Anthropic, OpenAI, for example, to put a name on these things. That's in group one. That's the core.
Group one.
That's the center of this kind of radiating circle of shit. Then there are people who take those tools and build development tools on top of them. I guess they're people who work on Copilot and that kind of stuff.
And you're Steve Yeggies, so yeah.
Steve Yeggy, all the Copilot and Copilot contenders. I guess Claude is another one of these. I don't know if it's called, I think Claude is the fundamental model.
Yeah, or Claude Code or whatever.
The people that write all of those tools to do this stuff.
Group two, the people who write the tools, the dev tools specifically.
The development tools. So you've got the core tools, which like essentially, there are also people that write like the UIs and the front ends for these things. But okay, that's out into the public world. But from a programming perspective, there's sort of like, how does it get to us as programmers? Well, it starts with the core who write this stuff, OpenAI.
Right. Group one, the core.
And then there's like the Copilot people who introduce it into our tools.
Right. Group two.
Then there's the sort of broader swathe of people where it really fans out into programmers that use the tools.
Group three.
And I would say there's kind of like some subcategories of those. There's some people who, and maybe this is a general point, but let's see. There are some people we know in our own community that use these tools very enthusiastically, and they don't give a fuck. They have no cares in the world about what's the externalities of these tools. They assume either they're just like monsters and they don't care about all of this stuff, which is one option, I guess. But without judgment, I would say that they're more enthusiastic and more excited, like children, I would say, to some extent. About the shiny new thing than they are about about all these externalities. I mean, and again, let's just be clear. These people know there are problems. They know there are issues, but they don't give a fuck. And let's just really nail that. So that's one group of people.
So let's call them group 3A.
3A, okay.
3A.
Maybe we need a name for them rather than a okay. Number and a letter. This is very programmer. This is very... it's either biblical or programmatical, you know?
Well, we've talked about them before, right? So within the programmer camp, let's say 3A are the AI enthusiasts, maybe.
AI enthusiasts. I like that, yeah.
Okay.
And we don't call them 3A. We just call them...
3A, the enthusiasts, yeah.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
Okay. AI enthusiasts.
I'll edit
brackets,
this.
3A, close brackets.
All right. So in the programmer group, then you said there are kind of three subgroups. So we have the enthusiasts.
So there's the enthusiasts. And again, these people, they know all the problems, but they don't give a fuck. And then there's the sort of the curious cats, the people who are, well, they're kind of interested in this stuff. They heard a lot of the hype, heard a lot of the buzz. Maybe they are a bit concerned about some of this stuff, but they want to see what all the hype is about.
Sure.
They want to sort of test it out themselves. So I think those people, the curious group, let's call them the curious group.
All right. 3B, the curious cats.
They're sort of like, they want to try it before they buy it type thing. Maybe it's they're kicking the tires, you know?
Kicking the tires, yeah.
And I think no judgment on those people. I think if you're curious about the technology, you want to see whether all the hype is worth, whether the hype is real, then I think that's, you know, it's fair enough to have a look. I don't blame those people.
Sure.
And, there's a lot of people like that who are just, responding to the hype, essentially.
So that's 3B, the curious cats.
3B, okay. the curious cats, yeah. Yeah, they're interested in checking out whether the hype is real and what's all going on here. So,
and then what's the third subgroup?
And then there's the final group, the group which... Maybe they're coming out of school, or maybe they're middle of their career or whatever. They're not just curious, but they feel somehow that they're under threat. And that's another part of the hype in some respects.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you don't get on this hype train, and Steve Yeagy has famously said this, if you're not on the hype train, it's coming anyway. It's part of the inevitability narrative. So you're just going to get left behind.
Or run over, depending on the metaphor you like.
Yeah, you're gonna get left behind, or you won't be able to get a job.
Yeah,
this is what I would call like the desperation group,
mm-hmm.
or the seeking employment group. The people who are, and this is happening to a lot of people in a lot of companies as well, where management is talking to them in a way that essentially is putting metrics on their AI use.
Right. And we're not even, I just want to really like emphasize this, like we're not being hyperbolic here. Like this is actually happening where companies AI targets and workers are like, why are you not using, AI for 80% of your tasks? Because that is the benchmark. So yeah. Okay, great. So now we've got the groups out there. So just to recap, we have group one, which is the people who are writing the core tools, the models, doing the research. We have group two, who are the people building development tools on top of the core tools. And then we have group three, who are programmers who are using the tools. And in that, we've split that into group 3A, who are the enthusiasts, the people who just love the stuff so much. They may acknowledge their problems, but they don't care. Or they may say, I'm just not worried about any of these. Then we have group 3B, who are the curious cats. And these are the people who are just like, okay, new technology, I'm going to check it out. I'm going to kick the tires, as you said. And then we have group 3C, who are the people who have been told that this stuff is inevitable and you will not get a job without knowing how to use this stuff.
I think they're fear-driven. Maybe that's the interesting part about the last part, is that everyone else is kind of like some degree of enthusiasm or willingness.
Okay.
And the last group are the group driven by fear.
Yeah, that's good. So we have these groups, and I think we need to speak with each of these groups differently, right? Mm. And that's why we have split them out into groups, because the arguments that will sway, group 3C are not going to work on group 2, right? These people are just, they have a different worldview. They think about these things in a different way. So I also think that we need to make deliberate choices about where to spend our time and energy.
Yeah.
Because the 3A, the enthusiasts, if it's my best bud who's an enthusiast, my best friend, maybe it's worth my time and energy to try to bring them back, from the brink.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe it's worth it. But if it's just a random person in the Clojure community and they're in the 3A category, and we know people like this, right?
Sure,
we know
sure.
people like
yeah.
this.
Yeah.
I am not going to waste my time trying to convert an enthusiast or trying to get them to open their eyes to know, but there are real dangers and real harms here, and you need to reckon with those. Because again, like if we look at our prerequisites for a good faith conversation, they just aren't there.
Yeah.
Because this person is unwilling to acknowledge the harms or unwilling to acknowledge it, that the harms are as harmful as we assert. So, Ray, let's unpack how we talk to each of these groups.
Okay.
And where do you want to start?
Well, I mean, maybe we can just quickly go through, I mean, probably from group, the first group who are the core group, the second group are the tools group, and the third group are the enthusiasts. To a large extent, I think we're going to have to write them off in terms of this conversation.
Okay.
Because most of them don't want to engage in good faith, according to at least our conception of a good faith argument.
Okay. So 1, 2, and 3A, you're saying don't talk to them.
I'm not saying don't talk to them, but I'm saying that it's going to cost you a lot of energy and a lot of time. And you're definitely going to have to use different arguments in each of the groups. I completely agree, because some of them are going to take more philosophical arguments rather than practical arguments. But overall, I think if you're in a camp where you're aware of all of the real harms, the material harms that are occurring right now, and you don't give a fuck, then it's very hard to argue with you. I think that's my bottom line. And if I'm having a conversation with somebody and I mention, we've talked about the various externalities, about three or four things. I mean, if you talk about like the energy cost, the labor exploitation, the closing off of the commons, you know, essentially the sucking up of all human content, the surveillance, you know, all of these things which are done in service of this AI, then I feel like it's like talking to a missionary who is going out there, you know, preaching the Lord's work while essentially giving people smallpox and killing them.
Yeah. Yeah, the smallpox laden blankets. Yeah.
You know, they believe it's almost like a belief in God. And I think there is I think we spoke about this before in our earlier conversations. There is a religious aspect to this stuff. And because it's quite religious, there's a sort of belief system. And talking people out of beliefs rather than out of, I almost would say, and I think it's been said by other people, that we're entering a new dark age. And I don't mean in terms of dark matter or dark whatever. I mean dark in the sense that we're giving up on rational arguments. The Renaissance was all about rational arguments. Whether you fully agree with the Renaissance or not, I want to say that reason and rationale and the scientific method were good things to come out of the Renaissance. And I'm not going to give that up.
It's so funny that the R in Tescrail, right, is for this new rationalist movement, and yet they're advancing these dogmatic anti-rational arguments. It's just so ironic.
Yes, 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 yes. I feel like that if you're involved in a kind of argument against reason, it's a belief system, then I think it's really hard to dissuade people from their path.
Right, right. And, you know, to go back to our rules of engagement, that really is the, you know, you said there is no fate. You must adopt the Sarah Connor position. There is no fate because these people believe in inevitability. I totally buy that, Ray. And whilst I don't want to let these people off the hook, tell you what, let's kind of hang them on their hook for a minute. And let's start our discussion on how do we talk to groups 3B and groups 3C, right? So the curious cats and the fear-based people. Let's just start there.
Yeah.
And I want to maybe start with the curious ones. So I'll give you my take on how we talk to the curious, and let's see what you think.
Go for it. Yeah.
Again, you know, just to kind of redefine this, these are programmers. I would say these maybe tend toward the more experienced end of the curve, the curious cats, because generally speaking, the more experienced you are as an engineer, the longer tenure you have, the less worried you are about your ability to find another job, like by and large. So sure. Let's just stipulate that for a moment. So why are you looking into these tools? Well, I would say the thing that differentiates you, a curious cat, from the fear-driven crowd is that you just want to see like, hey, is this tool a thing that might be helpful to me, right? Is this going to accelerate me? Is this going to increase the amount of leverage I have? Because the whole reason, And let's even zoom in on the closure community. So the community that we know so well, these experienced engineers have come to closure, you know, through a whole variety of different languages usually, because they found that closure's leverage frees them up to spend more of their time doing the hard part of programming, which is thinking through problems. And they spend less of their time typing out the code that solves these problems.
Yeah, and also, and this is a slight aside, but please bear with me, is that people are being asked to rewrite their code in languages that are more favorable to AI usage.
Right.
And that from the closure community, that's pretty bad. You know, where you came here and you've worked in closure for so long because all of the values of closure are simplicity, ergonomics, immutability, all of these things which we've kind of, you know, that the inventor of closure saw as problems in other programming languages. And in order to keep your job now, you have to rewrite this stuff in the languages that you went away from to keep AI happy.
So yeah, you're absolutely right. And the interesting thing is that these LLM tools effectively give you leverage, right? And we've seen this, you know, years and years ago before LLMs. So Java is a famously boilerplate heavy language, right? Java is very
verbose,
yeah. Very verbose. You have to write a lot of stuff. So our answer to that as a community was we created dev tools that wrote the boilerplate for you.
Right.
And this makes perfect sense. So in Java, the classic example is I have my class, you know, my enterprise Java bean, mm-hmm. and I have some fields that hold the data. And of course, I need getters and setters for these fields. So, you know, I have a person, which means I have a name, age, and address. So I tell IntelliJ, my IDE, generate getters and setters for me. And it does it. And, you know, what that tool is doing is giving you leverage. So it's freeing you up from the mental task of having to write the getters and setters yourself and like maybe make a typo and maybe forget a setter here. And that's fine, though, because you know exactly what the generated code is going to look like. So this is no problem at all in my mind. So this is an example of a coding tool giving you leverage in a low leverage language. But the reason we have other programming languages besides Java or beside, you know, we talked about previously machine language, assembly language, you know, these languages that get the job done, but are super hard to read, right? Mm. So the reason why we developed other programming languages, we wanted to give ourselves more leverage with the language itself so that we don't need all of this tooling around it. And what you've just described in companies that are closure companies, or at least companies with closure teams, is they're saying, you have this high leverage language, but unfortunately, it's not compatible with our LLM coding tools. So please switch back to a low leverage language so that you can then add leverage back with these AI tools, which, by the way, generate code that you probably can't understand.
Yes.
This just makes my head explode.
Yeah. I want to add a little bit to that because I feel like these things like getters and setters, the tools can generate those things. They can generate these equals and hash codes and all this kind of stuff. And this is all great things. So then the question is, well, what happens when you sort of see that and you say, okay, we can generate this code. And so essentially you're implementing kind of macros in your IDE.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly that.
And then the question is like, well, okay, if we can do that at sort of one level, and this is like Ruby on Rails. Well, why don't we just take these frameworks and you say you want a blog or you say you want a website. Okay, so just essentially Rails knew my blog, yeah? And it just generates all of that scaffolding needed to set up a database, set up all the middleware, set up the client. And all of this code, by the way, and this is to the argument about LLMs, is all of this code has been written by somebody else. Or it's been written by the program, Ruby on Rails, and generated out. And you really don't know what it's doing when it's happening. But, and also you kind of can't change very much of it. You know, you're buying in to a world view of the Ruby on Rails people. And that's kind of like, it can be good or bad. I mean, again, it's a leverage thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
you're buying into the concept that, well, yeah, we basically agree that these are the components of a modern website. You know, that's what it looks like. So you can go with it. And then if you want to change something, well, you know, there's limits. You know, so you might want to change something and it can be quite straightforward, a little bit of styling or a little bit of column here, a column there on the database. But when you want to change something because the performance sucks or because it's insecure or whatever, well, you're kind of, you've already bought into the other person's perspective and all of their code. And then Spring Boot has done the same thing for Java. There's all these kind of frameworks which essentially generate me a program. And in the framework world, you're always outsourcing your ideas to another group. And there's a normative idea that there is a way of doing something. You know, there is a way of making a website. There's a way of making a library. There's a way of doing this. There's a way of doing that. I think there's a normative tendency. There's a tendency amongst programmers to sort of to believe that there will be a one true way.
We're always searching for it, yeah.
Yeah, we're always searching for it. But what's really interesting to me is like, there's a sort of group of people who use Spring or use Rails or whatever. And those people are basically, I don't want to ask too many questions. I just want to do something, you know, I just want to get on with my life.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic example, Ray. And you're pointing to something very interesting, which is, like you said, this can be good or bad. And I would say things like Ruby on Rails or PHP, in a way, have been amazing for, you know, the software development community, because what they do is they allow a, let's say, junior developer, and I'm sorry to use that word, let's say new developer, inexperienced developer, it allows them to effectively run a command and get a blog. And actually, I would argue this is a wonderful thing, right? Because this allows people to get started with something. And then, like you said, like they make first minor changes. And again, you know, Rails and Django and Python and so on, they make it very easy to make minor cosmetic changes and kind of add basic functionality on top. And then at some point, like you said, you do get to this point where you need to change something fundamental. However, because of the gentle learning curve, at that point, you might actually be able to make, you know, that change. You might have gained enough experience. Now, there will always be a brick wall. But at that point, now you have enough experience to perhaps, I'm going to now move away from my Rails app. I'm going to roll my own blog because now I know how to do it. I know what the traps to avoid are. And I would say this is great. But there's a big difference between this and the LLM approach, right? Because again, with the Rails new blog, every time you run that command, you get the same thing. So this is very predictable. And like you said, this code has been written by someone else, but the key is someone else, a human being, a thinking programmer who has taken best practices and patterns and applied them to this. And yes, they are, like you said, limiting. They are reductive. However, this is the way to write a basic blog or a basic to-do list. So it's fine because, again, as you as a new developer gain experience, you also kind of internalize the thinking of the programmer who wrote the one true blog. So with an LLM, this is totally different. If you say, ChatGPT, make me a blog, or not ChatGPT, but, you know, Claude Code, write me a blog in Python, every time you give that prompt, you're going to get a slightly different response, right? So I think this is the big difference, and this is what's terrible because, again, as an inexperienced programmer, you don't gain that experience because there is no consistency of thought.
Right, right. Yes. You know, again, you can guide it along to say, use Django to make this blog, but
right,
you're kind of in double trouble, aren't you? You know,
you are. Yeah,
because you get the consistency of Django with the inconsistency of this machine.
Right. Yeah. So let's go back to the Clojure community. So these experienced engineers have come to Clojure because they found that Clojure's leverage frees them up to spend more of their time doing the hard part of programming, which is thinking through problems. And they spend less of their time typing out the code that solves these problems. So these people are like, great, will the LLM coding tools give me even more leverage on top of this and free up even more of my time to think? I'll even compare this to pair programming. So there's a model of pair programming where the person at the keyboard, all they are is a smart input device. So their partner is doing the programming, but they're programming in ideas. And they're saying, okay, so Ray, I think what we need is a function that takes this JSON, extracts these five fields, puts it into a map, and does this transform. And you know, you as an expert programmer can just write this function quickly, so I don't have to switch my brain in from problem-solving mode into typing mode. And I would say part of the curious cats, like their desire is like, okay, can an LLM just do this for me?
Right, right.
Can it do this so I don't have to rely on another programmer to sit with me and write code in this aspect? So these people, to be honest, I'm willing to give these people not a pass exactly, because I think we do need to engage with them. But I am willing to kind of, like, I don't really judge these people harshly for deciding to give this a whirl. So how do we talk to these people, Ray?
I think, first of all, it comes back down to the externalities, that if you're going to be curious about it, and it's going to, there are kind of like many reasons to be curious, but let's stipulate that it's a good reason. Like, you know, you want to find out whether it's worth the hype, essentially, whether it's going to improve your life. Whether that's a good enough reason, I'm not sure, but let's just say that it is.
Yeah.
Let's accept that, you know, improving one's life is a good enough reason.
Yeah.
I think it's morally questionable. I'm just saying that, you know, just because it improves your life doesn't mean to say that you should automatically accept something.
Right. But I think that's like you're getting at something core here. I would say that the desire to explore something because you think it might improve your life, I would say that is a good enough reason.
Yes.
If you don't understand the externalities and the harms done. So I think, is that where we start this conversation? By pointing to the harms?
It's tricky on the one hand, but I think pointing out, let's just remind everyone, and this is what I do. I tend to say that the LLMs are, I think there's two parts. Number one, I think the LLMs themselves are actually not that good. They're doing lots of magic tricks to appear to be plausible. And I think this is the sort of, this is the metric that a lot of the AI companies want to pass, which is plausibility. Now, the thing about programming is that plausibility is not good enough. It has to be correct, because computers are famously annoying if you don't put in the right program.
Right.
And I'm sorry to all the people out there who don't think this is true or don't know this is true. You know, if you, computer does what computer's told to do.
Yeah.
And if you don't tell it the right way, it will do something wrong. That's what a bug is. When you write a program, if it exhibits faulty behavior, it's because you've told it to.
Right. And it's funny because there's a like class of feature in many editors, which is called DWIM mode, right? Do what I mean, not what I said.
Oh, right.
Computer, okay. Do what I mean. Yeah.
That's what the AI is meant to do, isn't it?
Exactly that.
Yeah. Do what I mean. You know, I think as an ambition, that would be delightful, you know, and that's what we struggle with that every day, to be honest. And I think maybe people are looking for that also. It's like, how do I express myself through prompts or through English or through some other language? How do I get to an approximation of that in the code? How do I make a spec that is so tight that this machine or this other person can implement it correctly? I mean, it's kind of like annoying because we know through our own history as experienced developers that in the end, writing a spec, at a certain point, you might as well just write the code.
Exactly.
Because writing the spec is tedious to the point where you're almost at the point where you're writing the code. If you have to give it so much detail, and if you don't give enough detail, then there's room for misinterpretation and problems will occur, bugs will happen.
Right.
That's where I tend to start, to be honest, is that, no, we can talk about all the externalities, but I would start with the fact that it's just not that good.
You're coming on to a really key thing, right? So if we go back to our rules of engagement for a good faith discussion, we have, there is no fate, and no external being or force controls the world. I think the curious cats, there's no problem there. They're probably not anchored in that because they're not coming from a dogmatic point of view. There is also no problem with the agreement that humans are made and should be treated equally. I think that, again, there's no problem with the statement that information is always partial because that's what's motivating the curious cats, right? Yes, they're trying to gain information. I also think the policies are a human choice and can be remade requirement. That's not a problem at this point because we're not really talking about regulation and so on. But I think we need to start with this idea that computer systems can be better than humans in some tasks, right?
Sure.
And I think you and I need to open by just saying that up front. Hey, we're not saying that these LLMs are useless. And I think that's a key problem that some very well-meaning Luddites make, right?
Yes.
That's an error to lead with, this stuff is all shit, it's worthless, ha ha ha, look at the LLM making this obvious mistake here. No, we don't start there with the curious cats. What we do is we say, okay, yes, this stuff can help you to some extent. Given that, though, let's explore the limitations of this stuff. You know, maybe that's the first way in. And that's where we come back to your what you were talking about. Once you engineer the perfect prompt, once you get the requirements so tight that there's no room for interpretation, you know, you might as well be writing the code, because that's the difference between an experienced programmer and a new programmer. Like, and this is the point that Zach Tellman is making in his piece on senior agents.
I think we can call Zach Tellman out on it, by the way.
Oh, definitely. He wrote the shit in public. I mean, if you write stuff in public like that, you know, you're opening yourself up to a public response, right? And I think, you know, it's also fair for us to say, like, that, you know, we're deeply disappointed in Zach Tellman for this, a well-respected, thoughtful guy doing this shit. I mean, as usual, Zach, like, it's fucking well written. I mean, the dude is smart. He's a great writer.
Yeah.
However, it feels like he's playing to an audience, like you said. Like, it's his come and get me, you know, like when a footballer wants a big club to swoop in, you know, it's like, hey, look at how brilliant I am.
I'm over here.
Yeah. He's walking through the differences between a junior and a senior engineer. And then he's trying to show how you can evolve an AI agent from the junior to the senior. But one of the things he says, and I think this is a very compelling point, I think we have all experienced this in our own careers, that with a junior engineer, you need to give them a very tightly defined, very well-scoped task, and you need to give them nearly complete specifications, right? And they are effectively translating your ideas, translating your prose into code. And that's pretty much all they can do. And then you need to come in and do a really tight code review. You know, you need to pay attention to every line.
There's back and forth. And I think there's a lot of back and forth.
Of course, there's back and forth. And I think this is where the LLM coding tools are at the moment, because every of the curious cats, you know, the people who are not predisposed to, the people who have not drunk the Kool-Aid and are not predisposed to feel that this is inevitable, these people are, you know, I need to see the code that comes out the other side, because again, my goal is to understand if these tools can be useful to me. So I'm going to read closely the code and I'm going to engage in this back and forth, right? So there's a big difference here between the way these people are using the tools and the vibe coders, because the vibe coders don't even read the code, right? They don't care. All they want to see is the system doing the thing that they've specified.
I think vibe coders could potentially read the code and adopt it if they wanted to, but yeah, that's a subset. That's a small subset of the people. But overall, I think the people who are curious about the LLM producing the code that a junior developer could produce, they do care about the code, and they're trying to say, well, you know, can it do a good enough job or a similarly good enough job that I would do, or that, you know, a colleague of mine would do?
Exactly.
And that's the kind of bar they're looking at. I would say that on the whole, again, it's one of these things with these tools, is that they're very plausible and they can kind of come close, you know, and it could even get a working program. And I think that I mean, again, to a lot of people, that feels like magic, even to programmers, you know, that a program could write another program.
Right.
Now, so one of the things that, sorry, go on, Josh.
Yeah, no, I was going to say there, I think with the curious cats then, and we made this point last week when we discussed inevitability, I think we must insist on maintainability of the code. Right, and I think right. The curious cats, like you said, a lot of them are insisting on that because they are reading the code that's generated yes. and they're deciding whether to incorporate it. They're maybe editing the generated code to make it better. So I think maybe that's where we, with these people, when discussing this, let's really dive into the idea of we have to have maintainable code, because I think we can build a really strong kind of bridge there yes. with them
yeah.
and
yeah.
then talk through, like, will these tools get there? Because as you pointed out earlier, in the context of trust, there is this spectrum, and there's a very slippery slope from the low stakes environment where I'm just exploring these coding tools to see how good they are. Oh, okay, they seem to work for this and that. And all of a sudden, before you really realize it, you are starting to use these tools in higher stakes environments because you've Yes. been conditioned, you've seen they can do simple things reasonably well. So I think by anchoring our discussion with the curious cats, if we anchor it on the maintainability aspect, and we must insist that our code is comprehensible and can be owned by humans, I think we can probably pull these people back enough where at least they establish a strong precondition. I will not use these tools in production until the code they generate is actually maintainable. And we think that it won't get there, right? So maybe that's how we talk to them.
I think it comes back to trust again.
Right.
What a more focused path for trust. So do I trust that this thing will generate code that compiles? It's not always, by the way, it's not always guaranteed.
No, exactly.
You know, because a lot of code that it generates either fails because it makes up functions or it makes up libraries or it makes up keywords in the language. So there's this kind of, like, you know, phase one, does it actually compile? Does it run? You know, and a lot of them are getting to the point where they will run, where they will compile, they will run, they will do something.
Right.
And that's an improvement from where it was probably a year ago. There's more trust that it can actually emit workable code. Then the question is, okay, if we can trust that it will actually emit code that does pass the basic compiler or the basic language checks, then the next degree of trust is, does it actually do what we want it to do? And that's where you get into vibe coding, because people are like saying, okay, well, now it does what I want it to do, so let it just do it, you know? But there's an important gap here that you're really emphasizing, which is, okay, it might do what it wants to do, but is it doing it in the right way? Is it the correct level of quality? And that's where the curious cats can be persuaded, I think, like you say, to be, you know, it's not about you prompting hard enough. And prompting hard enough is the classic religious answer. You know, you're not holding it right. You're not,
exactly.
You know, you're not.
It doesn't work. Prompt harder.
Yeah, prompt harder. Yeah. The prompting will continue until morale improves, you know, so those kind of things. So, I mean, a friend of mine recently said, oh, we had this AI produced some code and then we spent 3 days debugging it. It's like, well, again, in terms of leverage, how long do you spend debugging these things, reviewing these things to the point where you just get too exhausted and you just think, I might as well just write it myself. It's not actually adding anything. It's distracting something.
Or worse yet, you get so fatigued from debugging this stuff that you decide, like, well, okay, but actually it's good enough. Am I being a perfectionist? You know,
yes,
this idea
yes.
that don't let perfect be the enemy of good. That's a very useful saying, but like all useful sayings, it has limitation because there's a whole lot of context that's being lost. So you can easily convince yourself that, like, oh, am I just letting perfect be the enemy of good? Like, because this code is working. Yeah, sure, there are these edge cases it doesn't quite handle, but how likely am I to hit these edge cases really?
You can talk yourself out of quality very easily. And there's a lot of pressure at work, especially just to allow these edge cases through, just to say, okay, well, there are edge cases, we'll document them. And the problem with the LLM is that in order to get to these edge cases, you have to look at the code. And then once you see these edge cases are there, then you have to, some third party has written this thing. Do you accept it or not? I would say, again, to the curious cats, is there's a reputation on the line here.
Right.
Your reputation, if you're the one that's actually committing this code and signing this code, then it's your reputation on the line. That's important for these people.
Yes, that is important. I think if we start our conversation with the curious cats on this point, okay, curious cat, we must insist on maintainability and comprehensibility of the code because your reputation is at stake here. I think now we have a trampoline to talk about the actual harms of this stuff, because now we can come back to the, is it worth exploring this thing because I think it can improve my life? Mm-hmm. Well, no, because of all of these harms. So I think we've really got a way to talk to 3B, the curious cats. So now let's get into how do we talk to 3C, the fear-driven crew. And my initial reaction is like, hey, we talked about that last week because the fear-driven crew have bought into this idea of inevitability, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Because they, you know, the Steve Yeager who says the AI train is coming and you either jump on board or you're going to be left behind or worse yet, you know, run over by the AI train. Now you're unemployable. Now, again, as we've talked about, the social agreement that we've made under neoliberal capitalism is work or die. Mm. So if you can't work, you die. And that sucks. So I can really sympathize with these people who feel that I must remain relevant.
Yes.
I must use these AI tools. And again, as you said, sometimes this is being mandated by their employer. You need to use AI tools for 80% of your tasks, or it's a performance improvement plan for you, or in the United States, it's like, goodbye. You know,
you can
be fired for no cause.
I would say from an empathetic perspective, if it's fear that's driving you, then it's very hard to say that you're going to get talked out of it. And I want to sympathize with those people.
Right. Right.
Because if you are kind of being forced to work in that environment, I've got no judgment on you. So I feel like, you know, you're the kind of people who you might even know all the harms that are being caused by your work, but you need the job, you know?
Exactly. So maybe we start with that group by validating their feelings.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I understand what you're feeling. I want to listen to you. Talk to me about your fear. Hey, that's a real fear. You are 100% valid to feel that way. And then where do we go from there?
Yeah, I think it's difficult because if they're being, the whole point about a lot of these things is that they're being surveilled.
Yes.
And because they're being surveilled, it's...
By the group two people, by the way, the ones who are building the tools on top of the
core exactly.
Models.
It's group one and group two are building the tools to surveil group 3C, the fear group, to give the management. And again, we have to look at this as annoyingly, guess what? It all comes back to a class struggle.
surprise.
I know. But it does come back to the fact that why are those people being driven to adopt AI? Why are they being driven to do this? And they're typically being driven to do it because, well, two reasons. Number one is greater productivity has been promised.
Right.
And group one, the people at the core where the vast majority of the capital has been sunk, you know, they're desperate to get this money back. I think at a global scale, it's likely that a lot of these AI projects in the real world will fail because it's clear that this thing is not good enough. So I don't think there's inevitability. But if you're in a fear-driven place, if you're in an environment where the manager is making you do AI, I think there's sort of, like you say, we empathize with those people. If you're being made to do AI, you have to do it. I think the main thing for those people is to say, okay, well, look, you're a programmer, you're a thoughtful person, you're a smart person. why not look at what this thing is doing, what it's creating, keep an analysis, not just of the number of AI prompts that you're using or the number of AI, how you're using this AI tools, but what it's producing and whether or not, from your perspective, you know, on your review, on your kind of weekly journal or whatever, what can you say about the quality or the lack of quality or the bugs or the, you know, what is this AI introducing? Keep a note of these things, keep a diary of these things, keep a journal of these things, and talk amongst your colleagues about whether, you know, get to materialistic analysis, the materialist analysis, is this thing actually working for the good or the harm of our software base? And I think these things are very interesting to discuss because we know that in reality, these things, in terms of maintainability, like you said before, it's a problem for maintainability where they're producing tons and tons of code. And I think as a professional developer, even if you're new to the game, you are going to have to look after that body of code. So this is a material harm or a material benefit. If it's all great, if the AI is generating awesome code that is completely bug-free and free of all security risks, then it's perfect, it's winning. And this is the kind of dream that everyone's being sold.
Exactly.
But we know that in reality, the code that it's producing is suboptimal.
Right, right. So I think these are great points. And I think if we start talking to these people with the, okay, validating their feelings and then really talking them through the inevitability stuff and trying to cast some light on the narratives that are establishing this inevitability idea, I think that's a good starting point. And then if we can get them to understand that, in fact, this is not inevitable, right? This is manufactured consent for AI tools. If we can get them to understand that, then we can ask them, okay, if this is not inevitable, what happens when the bubble bursts and the AI tools are all you know? What happens? Because I don't know if we've talked about this before, but one huge problem is, again, if we admit that these coding tools can be useful, I think we also, I feel at least, I'll speak for myself, that these tools are only useful in the hands of a senior engineer who can read the generated code, know if it's good, and make an informed decision on whether to incorporate it. But how do you gain that experience if you're a new programmer and you're only using these AI tools? Like you can't build that judgment really, or it takes a long time. So if you're that person and now the bubble bursts and you know, the collective programming world comes to its senses and realizes like this is not a good path. Now you are actually unemployable because, you know, you can't pass the coding interview because now a human is required. You, the human, are required to write the code. In other words, you're fighting fear with fear here, right? So you're saying, okay, you're afraid of being unemployable if you don't know this stuff, but, you know, what about the fear of being unemployable because this is all you know? And I think if we dig into why these people are afraid, it boils down to the fact that they are vulnerable, right? And they're either vulnerable because they are, you know, relatively junior engineers, relatively early in their career. Therefore, there's a large supply of people like you. Therefore, you know, it's harder to outcompete others for the jobs that are available for junior engineers. And by the way, as companies buy into this idea that we no longer need junior engineers because we have LLMs, the supply of available jobs is constrained even farther. So I think this is one reason these people are afraid. Now, there's another group of vulnerable people who are afraid who are experienced engineers, but you know, they are members of marginalized groups who are usually the ones who are first on the chopping block, you know, people of color, trans people, you know, and we have friends in these categories who are, they're like, I need to be the model employee because any excuse my employer has to get rid of me as a troublesome, you know, because again, we want apolitical workplaces, but if you are a person of color or a trans person, you are inherently political because society has said your very identity is a political statement. So, okay, we got to get rid of you. And by the way, you're not hitting that 80% AI quota, so you're gone. So these people, you know, at least friends of ours, they agree with us that it's not inevitable, but they need to keep their heads down. And I think those people, we do not need to talk them out. You know, they are making a very informed decision based on their lived experience. And those people, I think we need to give a complete pass to, you know, do what you need to do to survive. So is there anything else we need to say to the rest of that 3C group, the rest of the fear-based group? Is there anything else we need to say to them in conversation?
The one thing I was going to say, I mean, I don't know if it's worth saying to those people, but I think it's worth making a point in general, which is that one of the, I mean, we've said this before, but one of the reasons why AI is being introduced is to reduce labor costs or to replace labor.
Right, right.
And that's what generates the fear. Yeah. I think the other thing which we see in the world is that once AI is introduced, the terms of employment can be changed to be more precarious. And I feel like that is fundamentally the end game of a lot of corporations.
Exactly.
It's not necessarily to have all of their code produced by AI.
Exactly.
They want a sort of cooperative workforce, but they also want a workforce which is much more of a workforce that's in the precariat rather than a workforce which is kind of pampered. Like a lot of developers in the 90s and the early aughts was a pampered development and a group of pampered individuals, essentially. Pampered might be the wrong word, but certainly treated with respect and well compensated.
I think you've put your finger on something really, really, really important, which is these corporations, they have not necessarily drunk the inevitability Kool-Aid themselves because they don't need it to be inevitable.
No.
All they need is to turn their highly paid, hard to replace employees into the precariat, as you said. And I think there's, you know, we keep coming back to Uber. I think there's a great parallel here in that
yes,
the robotaxi is not the end game for Uber because it doesn't matter. The threat of the robotaxi allows them to make their workers more and more precarious because they have to accept more and more precarious conditions. Otherwise, they'll be replaced by the robotaxis. And at the end of the day, when the robotaxi doesn't emerge, it doesn't matter because Uber has already accomplished what it wants to. So I think we've laid out some really good, like a framework for discussion with groups 3B and C. So in other words, the curious cats and the fear-driven programmers. And we cannot give you a roadmap for these discussions because these are not mechanistic discussions. You know, as materialists, we need to understand that the individual circumstances matter. But what we're trying to do is give you some tools to think about how to engage in these one-on-one conversations, or if you're a person with a platform, how to talk about this publicly on your platform. So I want to now move to the group one and two. So the people who are working on the core tools or doing the research, and the people who are building development or coding tools on top of that. And I don't know if we want to talk about how we converse with them, but I do think that we need to discuss a bit the red lines here that are being crossed. So where do you want to go with this one, Ray?
I think it's an Oppenheimer conversation. We can relate to, I mean, they're curious cats as well. They're a different breed of curious cat, but they're a curious cat in their scientific research. And I think Oppenheimer and Einstein, all of whom worked on this Manhattan Project, actually, I don't know enough about all the individuals and what's in the hearts of these people on the Manhattan Project. But I feel like a lot of them came away from that feeling pretty bad about their involvement in it. You know, Oppenheimer famously said, you know, I have become the destroyer of worlds. What's the quote exactly?
I am become death. destroyer of worlds. Yep.
I've become death. I mean, come on, you know. Yeah. And honestly, I do not feel like it's an exaggeration to compare the two efforts, because in fact, I would say that the AI one is worse.
Wow.
And the reason for that, it's amazing that you say wow there, but the thing about the nuclear, if you play out the nuclear threat, it ends up in a situation where they're kind of unusable. I mean, they got used, and that's horrible, and they got tested. There were obviously real material negative effects. I mean, I get that.
But at the moment, they are regulated, right? They are regulated now.
They're regulated to some extent, but the main, you know, that's a kind of minor point. The major point is that their very existence in the hands of several large global powers kind of mean that they're unusable. So they're still being produced, you know, and this is like super annoying that they keep on refreshing the generations of nuclear power that they can never use, but they want to make sure that their stockade of this material is usable and up to date. So there's still a material harm going on.
Right. Because the only way to guarantee that they can never be used is to maintain technological parity, because you can't let the other side get first strike capability. Great point.
Yeah. So this is the sort of concern that is always driving the continued manufacturing of this stuff. But here, what we're talking about with AI, I mean, I would say that in terms of the material harm that's being done by keeping nuclear weapons going is relatively small. It does it does take some of the budget, which is, in my opinion, a waste. So it takes budget away from more meaningful things that could benefit humans. But still, it's a relatively small budget. It still means that we're kind of like mining nuclear, dangerous nuclear materials and stuff like this. So there's all kinds of externalities and negatives around the production, the continued production of nuclear weapons. But it's minor compared to the cost of data centers these days. Data centers are taking over three or four important human things. A, they're taking a lot of so-called clean energy, so water energy, wind energy, solar energy, all these kind of energy sources, which we're trying to accelerate the adoption of to reduce the greenhouse gases. They're absorbing all of these energies, which is keeping all the fossil fuel demands high. And now they're even talking about, like, I think Grok is using unregulated gas turbines to power its data centers.
What? Elon Musk is doing something amoral?
I know, but no. Yeah, but it's worth putting it out there. This is a terrible situation where they're materially harming the world, and it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. This is not something which is going to end up in, even if you end up in, and they're trying to use this war of words as well. We talked about this before with this sort of like China versus the US arms race in AI. All that means is that both parts are going to use more and more of the world's resources, more and more of the world's energy to produce these nonsense-making machines.
Exactly. So it's not like nuclear weapons, because there is no getting to the point of mutually assured destruction where neither side will use it, right?
Exactly.
So if we paraphrase Mark Andreessen, data centers are eating the world now.
Wow. Yeah. And also, the analysis of Mark Andreessen and people like him is that essentially we're living in a world of infinite resources. Well, their argument is it's not a world of infinite resources, but a universe of infinite resources. So we need to get off planet so we can exploit things. But capitalism and colonialism and exploitation of natural resources will drive us off the planet, will drive us to explore new territories, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly.
This is really crazy stuff that I feel like Group 1 and Group 2 at least need to defend.
Yeah, I think that's a great point.
And it feels to me like it's indefensible. So I'd like to see their defense. I've seen some ethical arguments about this test grill stuff we talked about before, the long-termist stuff, which is absolute horseshit. Come on.
It is, yeah.
It's very, very hard to defend. I would say impossible to defend. The Group 1 and Group 2, they're deliberately doing something which they know is harmful in the short term. They have to know that because they're not idiots. They know that it's harmful, but they're prepared to do it anyway. And for that, I'm going to say that we as a society, we need to judge them and judge them to be harmful to society.
Yes, you are doing something harmful. So I think, Ray, you know, again, going back to our rules of engagement for good faith discussions, if we want to talk to these people in groups one and two, we have to find a way to have a good faith discussion with them. And I think here is where it's not on us, right?
Right.
I think here we have to get them to agree to something. And, you know, one of the points that you made there that I think is really important is that these people do have arguments, right? The Tescaro people have their rationalist and their effective altruist, long-termist arguments. But I think what we need to insist on here is a materialist analysis of current conditions. Because what I've noticed about the Tescaro crowd is their arguments tend to be philosophical.
Yeah.
So you have Nick Bostrom, the patron saint of Tescaro philosophy. And they come up with all of these, you know, Pascal's wager or Pascal's mugging, you know, which we'll put in the show notes. They come up with all of these thought experiments to justify the unjustifiable, right? Mm-hmm. To defend the indefensible. And I think we have to, if we're talking to the group one and two people, we have to say, listen, we have to talk about the harms being done right now. And let's work through those harms. And we have to agree that on this reality, these things are happening. And then we can have the discussions about, okay, given that we agree that these are the things that are happening, how do you defend this position and keep bringing them back to the material? Don't let them escape into this, yes, but millions of years into the future territory.
Yeah, I think that's really good, the material harm and the sort of, how do you persuade people who are doing philosophy and the sort of thought experiment stuff that reality is real, that it matters?
Right.
I don't know, to be honest. I mean, one has to assume that at a certain point they will accept this, like Oppenheimer did. The other thing that I think might be worth discussing, I'm not sure if anything can reach these people, but the fact that they're being exploited or co-opted by fascist governments may or may not make them think twice about this endeavor that they're doing.
Right. That famous cartoon, you know, are we the baddies?
Exactly.
Yes, you OpenAI employee, you are in the SS, my friend.
You really are. I mean, you know, Trump and JD Vance are out there basically stormtrooping across the world, yeah, saying that we own this shit. And they basically own your ass at this point.
Yeah. Exactly.
The thing is that we know that, I mean, and I was talking about Karen Howe earlier, a great author, a great writer. We can put her book about empires of AI in the show notes. She's talking about the fact that this is an empire-based thing. So it's going to go to one of two ways. Again, the sort of politics of this is that the tech companies are going to end up owning the empire, or the right-wing fascist governments are going to end up owning the empire. The worry I've got is that a lot of these philosophies end up being very friendly towards fascism.
Yes, they do. So, Ray, we've been going for a long time, and, you know, we're in a pretty dark and gloomy place right now. And one of the things that we want to do with politics is we don't want to succumb to despair. So I really want to end this episode with something. Where is the glimmer of hope? Where is the lever of resistance that we can pull? And let's just end on that. How do we get out of this? Give me some hope, Ray.
Yeah.
A ray of hope, if you will.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the hope that I've got and the expectation that I've got is that this technology is just not working. Again, we've talked about this during the episode. There's a degree of plausibility in this technology, which is, you know, which is attractive to a lot of people. But I think fundamentally, it just doesn't do what people think it does to a good enough and to a high enough standard that they will be able to replace humans. We also know from our experience and knowledge about technology and programming and the AI models that this transformer model will not, no matter how much data you put into it, it's not going to turn into human level intelligence.
Yeah.
In the end, it's a probability machine, and that probability will always have some errors, and it will never be able to explain itself properly and it will never be able to, and it will continue to make mistakes, and many of those mistakes will be egregious. So my hope, like it or not, is that the whole bubble will burst. Now, it might well be that that, rather than bursting, it might transform.
No pun intended there.
a tiny bit of hope into non-hope, where the AI gets deployed into the military, where there's a lot of money, and into sort of government, where there's a lot of surveillance. So that's the kind of thing where maybe the AI lands. None of these things are very good for the AI proponents, and they're definitely not very good for us. But I think once this AI hype cycle comes out of the other side, and I perceive that's going to happen. Again, people have been saying the AI hype cycle is going to end in 6 months, in 12 months, in 3 years, in 5 years. I don't know when it's going to hype, but the money is going to run out soon. So that's my hope. The money runs out. The thing collapses in a bit of a heap. We go back to business as usual, but it's going to be business as usual is going to be different. Things are going to have changed. And I'm not quite sure how they're going to change, but my hope is that at least that part of the hype cycle will kind of end, and then we'll have to address what we're left with.
Exactly. So I think what politics listeners can do here, given that the bubble will burst, we hope. That's the hope. The bubble will burst. It must burst.
Yeah.
And, you know, to quote our great friend of the podcast, enemy of humanity, Milton Friedman, when a crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. So I think what we have to do is we have to keep speaking to our community and make sure that the ideas lying around are Luddite ideas where we use technology in the service of humanity. And that's really where I want to end the show today. So Ray, thanks so much for this great conversation, and talk to you next week.
Thank you, Josh. Yeah, awesome.
Before we sign off for this week, let's take a dive into our comments section and see what you, the audience, are telling us. On Apple Podcasts, we got a 5-star rating and a review from Cuzzy2344, and they say, thanks for starting up the show. I'm a software engineer, and it makes me feel so much less crazy that there are other dissenting voices out there in the field when it comes to AI and big tech in general. Keep up the great work.
Well, that's the kind of review we wanted, isn't it?
Yeah.
they're picking up what we're putting down.
Just want to assure you, there are many other people like us that we've talked to. I think it's unfortunate that people maybe don't feel comfortable speaking up about this stuff. But hopefully in this episode, we have covered some of the reasons why that is.
Yeah, I think pushing back against the dominant narrative is always tricky. So we appreciate the support, to be honest. It's always, I mean, you know, they're comforted that we're here, but also we're comforted that they're there.
Yeah, definitely.
The more voices we have speaking up, we'd like to be lost in a sea of podcasts talking like this.
Yeah. Great. Love it. So thanks again to you, and thanks to everyone else who's leaving the ratings on Apple.
And switching over to Spotify now, we have a few new comments, on episode 4, Surveillance. So our friend Oscar is back, and they say, so true that the AI has nothing to say. It's simply an echo of all the work it's devoured. The fact that so many people are transfixed by this fart machine makes me sad. Well, farts do have a tendency of making people sad. Thank you, Oscar. Then Samsky says, both botlickers and bootlickers won't be spared in the coming revolution. Grah! Vomit emoji, vomit emoji, fire, 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 boot, boot, boot. Well, Samsky's emoji game is certainly strong. Thanks for that, Samsky. Thanks also, Samsky, for your comment on episode 5, Inevitability. Lots more emoji here as well. Samsky says, surprised you guys aren't agrarian with how many W's you're farming. Exploding head emoji, fire, 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 fire extinguisher, fire truck, fire truck. Woo! Thank you, Samsky. I don't know why you're putting out our fire at the end there, mate, but we'll forget it.
And our friend Chicken Infamous is back, I assume anyway. We have someone here called Chonken underscore, which sounds to me like the chicken in disguise. Anyway, Chonken just says, facts, prayer hand emoji, prayer hand emoji. So in addition to farming W's here, it seems like we are seriously farming emoji. We love it. Thank you. Keep those comments coming. We also have an email here from Michael. And Michael was sharing a bit of their experience with us and said that they were struggling a bit with the inevitability episode, actually. And here's a quote that I want to read out from the email that kind of encapsulates their experience with our podcast. So Michael says, as I take in more of the AI boosterism, diving into its waters myself, your show may serve me as a safety line I can hold on to. Wow. Thank you, Michael. I really hope that we can be such a safety line for you. And thank you so much for your email. Thanks again to everyone who took time to leave us a comment. We really appreciate it. It's a lot of fun to read. If you want to get in on the action, just leave us a comment on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Send us an email. We love that. Or hit us up on socials. One other thing that would help us out is if anyone is interested in doing some of the transcription for the show, because that is a process that's time consuming. And we do believe in making sure that our content is accessible to everyone, even if they're not someone who can engage with the podcast in audio form. So if you're someone who would be interested in helping out with that, just drop us a line, please. Again, podcast@politex.dev email, or feel free to send a DM on social media or whatever. We would really appreciate that. And that's it for this week on Politex. Just a little bit of housekeeping before we go. We will actually be taking a week off, so our next episode will come out not next Monday, but the following Monday. Thanks for your patience, and see you then.
This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Politex. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you have given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@politex.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Politex on Blue Sky and at Politex at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is politex.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!